This episode contains language or topics not suitable for children. Ladies and gentlemen, boys and girls, welcome to episode 100. It's Jean Tiberio here, and I'm the host of Healing Outside the Box. Now, I had every intention of being peppy and upbeat about today's podcast, but truth be told, I'm feeling sad about what's happening to my friends across the pond. I'm speaking of the tragedy last night in Nice, France, where 84 people were killed and 52 more are critically injured. Je suis triste aujourd'hui. I am sad today for my French friends, because as I've said, I do so love the French, and I have fond memories of my 3 days in Nice many years ago. We had lovely meals with French wine in outdoor cafes. There is actually a picture of me in one of those outdoor cafes from back in 1983. The boardwalk looks a little like Atlantic City, but more upscale. There is another picture of me in front of the Matisse Museum in Nice. It was actually his residence for a while, and it sits on top of a beautiful hill looking down on the city of Nice. Someone painted a painting of that picture and gave it to me as a gift. I'll see if I can take a picture of the painting of the picture. Something Stephen Colbert would have done for sure. Anyway, I was hoping to have some really famous, important person as a guest on my 100th episode, but the minutes turned into hours, hours turned into days, etc., and I didn't get around to sending out all those emails. So here we are, you and I, with no special guest or brilliant idea for a topic. So I'm going off the beaten path, not with my cliches. Oh, no, no, I cling to my cliches like a baby blanket. No, I'm going off the beaten path by doing something different for this 100th episode. Next week, I'll talk about what's going on with the GMO labeling bill. But this week, I'm going to recite a chapter from a memoir I'm in the process of writing. It's basically about the relationship I have with my personal care attendants. It's not a tell-all memoir. Actually, it's more of a this-is-the-way-it-really-is memoir. I've decided to read the introduction in the first chapter of the memoir, which, by the way, I'm still editing. And if you so choose, I welcome your feedback and suggestions. I always love to hear from you guys. You can reach me through my website, which is healingoutsidethebox.com/contact, or you could email me at the following address, jtiberioj14@gmail.com. All I ask of you is to be nice, because my emotions are really close to the surface. By the way, does anyone remember where that line comes from? I'll let you think about it for a while, and you can send me a comment on my comment or contact page if you think you know the answer. If you don't want to think about it for a while, I'll leave it in the show notes. So my working title right now is Helpers Anonymous. I'm still working on the subtitle. Oh, one more thing. I just put up a Patreon page for my ongoing podcast. I suppose this would be as good a time as any to beg for your support if you so choose. I'd greatly appreciate any help so I can keep this thing going without commercials or promos. Thank you so much in advance if you do so. In exchange for, say, $3 an episode, I can either make up some recipes for you with your favorite ingredients, and then I can email them to you, or, if you so choose, I can send you a 3-ring binder with my favorite healthy recipes, and I can mail that to you via snail mail. If you'd like to donate, you can go to the patreon.com page and type in my name, but I'll also give you a link in the show notes as well. Okay, so the following is a recital of a draft of the introduction in Chapter 1 from my upcoming memoir called Helpers Anonymous. Introduction. Did you ever wonder what happens to the lost souls in our society after their own karma rains down on them? The lost souls, i.e. the drug addicts, the functionally challenged, the recently released, all have to go somewhere after we stop thinking about them. But where do they go? If you guessed that they become home health aides and care for people who cannot care for themselves, you would be correct. If you don't believe me, keep reading, or keep listening in this case. Now, out of the 100-plus home health aides that I've hired, I have met some great people and established relationships that have changed my life in a positive way. Many of these people have been competent, reliable, and caring. They have helped me to be productive and safe. I don't know what I would have done without them. But enough about them. This book attempts to give the reader a picture of the unique relationship between the disabled and the disabled caregiver. Like any dysfunctional relationship, this one almost always starts out harmonious before things go terribly wrong. You can't make this stuff up, folks. Seriously, you can't. My imagination wouldn't have stretched this far. This memoir is a bit memoir-ish if I were to be a stickler for details. The names have been changed, and the times have been rounded off and so forth. What I'm attempting to do is to allow you to have a glimpse into a very specific relationship between a disabled person living alone and the many caregivers that come in and out of her life. Now, I happen to have a rare form of muscular dystrophy, so presently these aides are literally my arms and legs. They wash and dress me every morning, feed me, scratch my nose, and shuffle through my embarrassing stack of overdue bills. They are my entourage of daily living. I am their therapist. But this special arrangement didn't happen overnight. I was diagnosed with muscular dystrophy back in 1982, and the disease progressed at a steady pace until about 5 or 6 years ago. Since then, the progression seems to have slowed down or stopped altogether. At this time, I don't have a lot of skeletal muscles left. I can wiggle my fingers, turn my head partially from side to side, raise my eyebrows, which I find very useful when I wish to be sarcastic. But as for moving anything against gravity, there's pretty much nothing left. I do, however, have a pretty good swallowing reflex and sensitivity to hot water and pain. All of my 5 senses, sight, hearing, touch, taste, and smell, are pretty much intact. Now, because of this disability, I need home health aides during the day and evening hours. A couple of times a day, I am left alone to do my napping and writing, in that order, for a total of about 5 hours per day. I am fortunate enough to live during the time of the tech explosion, and I use dictating software and voice-activated phone, TV, etc. to feel more secure when I'm alone. Throughout the telling of these stories, I imagine you'll be wondering why I don't simply fire my home health aides when they don't show up for work or shoot heroin in my living room. I certainly know that I would be wondering that as well. As it turns out, it's complicated. I used to wonder about other things like, why don't abused women leave their domestic violence behind them and move out? Why do alcoholics continue to drink after they start vomiting blood? Why do men occasionally or ever rape small children? Why do some women cut themselves when they're already feeling altogether too much pain? Why are poor people willing to go to war and die for rich people who started the damn war? Now, I hope you're not looking for answers, because I have none. What I hope to do with this memoir is to shed some light on a somewhat peculiar relationship between the disabled and the home health aides who care for them. Chapter 1. The Horrible and the Miserable. Nothing compels a non-writer to start writing quite like the opening to the movie Manhattan. The Gershwin music, the cinematography, and the lighting, which is all black and white, all weave together to make you feel that you're in for an experience. Woody Allen gets it right by never seeming to get it right. In the movie Annie Hall, Woody Allen says that, quote, life is divided up into the horrible and the miserable. The horrible would be like terminal cases and blind people, crippled. I don't know how they get through life. It's amazing to me. The miserable is everyone else. So you should be thankful that you're miserable, end quote. Well, I'm disabled, so I guess that makes me, spoiler alert, the horrible one. I need home health aides most of the day and evening to help me do just about everything. Over the years, I've had to hire many home health aides. By my recent count, it's about 120 people. So I consider myself a bit of an expert on the subject of this particular species of relationship. The relationship usually starts out positive and often goes sour, as any relationship can do. So the miserable, as Woody Allen would say, come into and out of my life. As I've mentioned before, I often try to examine why people do certain things. When was the craziness apparent? Never soon enough. Were there warning signs during the initial interview? Not obvious to me. Is there a way to avoid this? I wish I knew. Here are three stories of my relationship with a home health aide that fits into the category of the horrible and the miserable, aka the desperate and the helpless. After an interview with a particularly chatty home health aide applicant, I turned to the person that was with me and said, "She seemed nice." "You think everyone seems nice, Jean," came the reply. Jackie was part Lucille Ball, part Joan Crawford. As early as the day of the interview, I learned that she lived on a boat in the Beverly-Salem Harbor. She showed me pictures of her, quote-unquote, drawings, and bullet-pointed her many talents. She was about 6 feet tall, thin, and quite attractive, with long, flowing arms that fishtailed everywhere as she spoke. And speaking of fish, she mentioned that she and her other boyfriend, also with a boat, went cod fishing, and she would be sure to bring me some fresh filleted cod. Well, I saw how this could work for me and hired her. Although someone who is, well, out there is usually a mixed bag, she often cracked me up, and I saw that as a good thing. And speaking of crack, she also had a cocaine habit. Obviously, this did not come up during the interview. As is often the case with addicted employees, she had a temper and could turn on me easily. I sometimes got a certain devilish pleasure out of watching the expression on other people's faces when they met her. The outfits alone were precious. My family ran into her right after an annual 4th of July fireworks display a block from my house. She yelled out, "Jean," and we all turned. Jackie was waving her enormously long arms wildly and bounding toward us. She was wearing an extremely short miniskirt with cowboy boots. If anyone was capable of making a thud noise while walking outside, it would be her. Someone once asked me if she used to be a man, and my response went something like, "That would certainly make some sense, but no, she wasn't." On another evening, I was with two other women when Jackie walked in for her evening shift. She announced that she would let us chat and bounded towards the guest bedroom. About 10 minutes later, she returned, wearing a floor-length black negligee from a thrift shop. Her hair was pinned up with pastel-colored children's butterfly clips. A long cigarette holder would have completed this picture. We were chatting one evening when she mentioned that her boyfriend had put a restraining order on her after an argument had become physical. "When was this?" I asked. "Well, that's what I've been meaning to tell you." I've learned that nothing good ever comes from a sentence that sounds like that. "The cops came to your house at 2 a.m. on my second day of work when I was here. I'm surprised that you didn't hear them." "Well, I can thank Ambien for that, but my cat Betty was not as fortunate." I had been wondering why Betty was hissing and growling at Jackie since around that time. But there was a couple of months between the incident with the cops banging on the door and the day she decided to tell me. Apparently, according to her version, the cops banged on my front door to issue her a restraining order. Thinking it was her boyfriend pretending to be cops, don't ask me to explain the multiple voices, she yelled back, quote, "Go fuck yourself," end of quote. I imagine it didn't go well for Jackie after that, so she was issued a restraining order only 30 feet from where I was sleeping, and I never woke up. That was followed by numerous physical adventures with this same boyfriend, and she was arrested again in the presence of her 6-year-old son. This was followed by a custody battle with her ex-boyfriend, which she eventually lost. Ironically, one of the cops that arrested her on one of these occasions was familiar to both of us. His beat included my neighborhood, and I had called him on 3 occasions for crimes committed against me by 3 separate home health aides. The third time he walked into my kitchen, he said, "Jean, we have to stop meeting like this. Indeed, we do. When Jackie mentioned that it was a cop named Mike, she also unloaded a TMI on me. In her defense, she didn't know at the time that I knew him. She said, quote, "I know this cop, Mike. I had to blow him once to get out of a DUI," end quote. After she lost custody of her son, the verbal abuse worsened, as did the drug abuse. I could sense that she had nothing left to lose. I finally came to the conclusion that I couldn't take the abuse anymore, and I had to let her go. Actually, my sister did the letting go for me as I hid in the bathroom. I know what you're thinking, but try not to judge. Several weeks ago, I was frantically calling different people through my voice-activated phone when a home health aide no-showed and left me alone. By accident, I actually called her number, and she picked up. She gave me a resounding hello when she heard my voice. Apparently, all was forgiven, or perhaps forgotten. Janet. Many years ago, I had to fire a home health aide named Janet. Janet was treading water for years and doing a poor job finding her demons. She had begun to feel both the physical and mental effects of 30 years of heavy drinking, painkillers, and cocaine. It was a difficult decision because I did like her. However, she was coming in drunk on many days and dropped me on the toilet when she was too drunk to notice that she had let go of me. That was it. I had spent too much time worrying about her and about what would happen if she dropped me, and then she dropped me, and I got injured. There was an incident prior to that when she came in to give me supper. She was clearly drunk, and her speech was more slurred than usual. She made spaghetti for me and delivered it to the kitchen table in a coffee mug. I looked at the coffee mug, I looked at her, then I looked back at the coffee mug. At the time, I had been struggling with frequent episodes of chest pain, and the visiting lab had just made a third attempt to get a vein without success. At these times, I have a short fuse for other people's problems, and I drummed up the courage to let her go. About a month later, Janet went into a psychiatric hospital for 2 weeks. According to her sister, who felt the need to call me, she was so devastated that she no longer had a job that she reportedly said, "Because Jean fired me, I have to go to heaven." She then took a combination of pills and alcohol and nearly succeeded in killing herself. Shortly after her hospital stay, she paid me a visit. Her voice was no longer slurred and she seemed more clear-headed. Her family had given her $1,000 so she wouldn't attempt suicide again. However, she was still in denial about her drinking and substance abuse. No surprise there. Keeping my opinions to myself is not a strength I possess, but I could no longer get emotionally involved and said my goodbyes. A short time later, she had another suicide attempt and went to jail on a DUI. Janet reminded me about something a guy said who lives on the second floor of my building. He is also a disabled man who had home health aides and was teasing me about my relationships with mine. He said, quote, "Your home health aides have a tendency to go berserk while they're working for you. It seems like it must be you, Jean," end quote. Well, perhaps he may be right, because Janet was not the first, but actually the second home health aide who had to go to a psychiatric hospital after she left here. Chris. The memory of an old home health aide who worked for me years ago popped up from nowhere recently. Occasionally, I feel luckier than the women who have been paid to take care of me, and Chris was certainly one of those women. I was having a stressful week because two of my home health aides were sick. A third one and my sister had to run back and forth during their day jobs to take care of me. It seems to be the type of week when nothing else gets done, and I stay in my pajamas because it's too much work to get dressed. The fact that it was summer and I was stuck indoors for a few weeks makes me feel a little sorry for myself at times. My back pain had flared up, and I remember spending one evening praying for the pain to go away and worrying about my future. Tears were rolling down my cheeks as my sister tried to rock me forward and back to help alleviate the pain. At the time, a 10-minute stroll in the park next door seemed like a lot to ask for. But several days later, the pain subsided, and I was able to get outside for a few minutes. It was heaven on earth. The story about a woman named Chris from my past made me realize how blessed I am to be living in my skin with all my healthy and perhaps not so healthy body parts. After Chris had left her job here, another home health aide mentioned that she read in the newspaper about this woman who was arrested for prostitution. She had a business disguised as a home massage business. The apartment that she worked from was not far from here, actually, about 3 blocks. I was suspicious that it might be someone I know that had worked for me, and I was unfortunately correct. When she was here, Chris was a lot of fun to be around, joking a lot, dancing around the room, occasionally bringing me flowers that she had picked from a neighbor's garden. When she brought me these flowers, she would proudly claim that they were God's flowers, and she was therefore entitled to them. She would crack me up with stories of her wacky adventures. She actually once got herself arrested for parading around naked at a park during a celebration for the Witches of Salem. I apparently forgot to mention that. The police apparently couldn't get her to stop singing and prancing in her birthday suit, which made me a little envious of the people watching the show. There is simply nothing on a cop's belt to control a singing naked woman. But she also had her dark side. She claimed to be a recovering alcoholic, but I suspect that she was dabbling in cocaine as well as other drugs. I finally had to fire her for repeated no-shows and drinking up all my wine. Then, and this is the crazy part, I rehired her because she told me that she was clean and sober. I was also desperate because my home health aide, who was doing all week in the mornings, had just been arrested and put in a 30-day rehab hospital for stealing her doctor's prescription pad. Prior to this, Chris was increasingly desperate for money. She would ask me for $40 to get a pager, as her phone had been disconnected and I couldn't reach her. She gave me the familiar line, quote, "If you give me money for this pager, you'll be able to reach me when you need me," end quote. I fell for it and gave her the $40, but the pager never surfaced. Around this time, she unveiled her plan to make a lot of money quickly. Several years ago, she purchased a massage table and went through massage therapy training. She told me if she could offer massage therapy with oral sex, she could double the money. She announced this as if it were a new entrepreneurial breakthrough. As I miserably chewed on my sandwich, she graphically outlined the details for me, even to go as far as to tell me that she had a client lined up. I didn't want to burst her bubble by telling her it was a bad idea, so I listened in silence. Shortly thereafter, she threw a temper tantrum after I refused another request for money. My sister stepped in and said, quote, "I will not allow you to talk to my sister like that. If you can't talk in a civil manner, you need to leave," end quote. With that, she exclaimed, quote, "I quit," end quote, and walked out with my supper still on the stove. The next step is often surprisingly difficult. That is, getting back my apartment key. Without offering an explanation, she didn't want to return my apartment key to me. I regretfully asked both my father and sister to go to her apartment to get my key. I was waiting outside in the car while my father one day knocked on her front door. After about 1 minute, I saw her running out of the back door and heading down the street. On yet another day, my sister tried the same approach, knocking on her front door. This time she yelled back through her closed door that she was not willing to give up my apartment key. When Peg questioned her as to why, there was a garbled, incoherent response. After 6 attempts to get my apartment key, I called Chris's mother. I had her mother's phone number because she had been making long-distance phone calls to her that appeared on my phone bill. I suggested to her mother that I would give her one more day to return my apartment key, after which I would call the police and ask them to get it for me. In 2 hours, she was at my apartment with the key. She was clearly angry, but from what I could understand of her rambling dialogue, she still wanted to work here. I'm not so proud of the fact that this home health aide job was her stepping stone to prostitution, but I'm not that surprised either. The news of her decline was one of the first moments that I started to see a disturbing trend, one that we are all now aware of, and that is the alarming increase in people of all ages becoming addicted to opiate-type painkillers and heroin. Once the mainstream workforce rejects them for various reasons, they become private-duty home health aides, where there are no Cory checks, no drug tests, and no organization that they need to answer to. This was the story of the 3 people that I've mentioned here and so many others. End of chapter 1. That's all I have for you today. Next week, I'll be back with another episode of Healing Outside the Box, and I'll give you an update on the GMO labeling laws. Bye for now.